The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2022, Living Liberation, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, you can visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Hello, Libra Planet. This next talk is going to be Reducing Internet Address Waste, the IPv4 Unicast Extensions Project, and will be presented by Seth Schoen. Seth is a consultant living in San Francisco and helped develop the Let's Encrypt Certificate Authority. Yay! Please say.
Thanks a lot. It's really nice to be at Libra Planet again, at least virtually. And thank you very much for having me. And thanks everybody for tuning in. So I've been working on a controversial internet standards project, which does have a software component as well as a standards advocacy component. This is a project that was established by John Gilmore, whom many of you may know, a very, very long time free software and internet freedom advocate. And we've worked on it with several other colleagues. And thanks to everybody who's contributed to this in various ways. So this is a project that's trying to reduce the waste of Internet Protocol version 4 or IPv4 addresses that are not being used for various reasons, which I'll talk about in some detail. Just looking for slide 3 here. Slide 3 has a large graphic. That's why it's slow to load. So this is just a reminder of a saying that some people have said the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago, and the second best time is now. And that's really informed a lot of my thinking and talking about this, because we're talking about some changes that could have been made many years ago, and we might derive a benefit today if they had been made. They unfortunately haven't been made, but we still have an opportunity to do it now, potentially to benefit people in the future. So many of you will be aware of the issue of scarcity of IPv4 addresses. So IPv4 is the classic internet protocol. Its addresses are 32-bit numbers. So there are 2 to the 32 possibilities, which is about 4.3 billion. Now, Arvind Narayanan, a great researcher and privacy researcher, had a blog called 33 Bits. And he talked about how there are about 2 to the 33 people in the world. You might notice the proximity between 2 to the 32 and 2 to the 33 here. And Dr. Narayanan's point in his blog is that for privacy purposes, this is a fairly small number from the point of view of a computer, that it may seem like a lot to a human being. Wow, 7 or 8 billion people, that's a lot of people. But from a computer point of view, that's not a very large number. And in the privacy context, there are discussions about how if you had a small amount of information that's apparently not personal information, it may nonetheless easily be unique and single out a particular person. Similarly, this size number is not very big for an address space. And the internet was originally proposed as a kind of an experiment, a kind of a research project. It wasn't clear that it was going to become the main worldwide communications medium for the entire planet. And so choosing an address space that was comparable to the size of the world population did not really seem like a problem in the early 1980s when many of these decisions were being nailed down. A lot of these things seemed like no big deal because people didn't know where the internet was going. They didn't know where it was headed. And so a lot of the choices that were made at that time have had very significant impacts that have lasted up to the present day. And certainly through the 1990s, as the internet was growing very, very quickly, it became very clear that these addresses were scarce and they would actually run out. And traditionally, we wanted to give one address per device on the internet. And so the number of devices already was starting to approach the billions. And for various reasons, not every address can always be used, and some of them go to waste. And I'll talk about one reason that some of them go to waste, but there are other reasons as well. But it became very clear that we were going to run out of these addresses, and that this was actually a problem, that the internet was in a way a victim of its own success. And so the main community effort to deal with this and to address this scarcity was the creation of version 6 of IP, IPv6. The IPv6 protocol is meant as a successor to version 4, and V6 has 128-bit addresses, which is about 340 undecillion. If you want to see exactly how many, here's a command you can run to get it in words. These addresses are a lot longer. They're a lot bigger. There are a lot more of them. And I actually gave my first ever conference presentation in 1999 talking about free software support for IPv6. So there's a certain irony that now with this project, I'm continuing to work on the continued life of IPv4, and some IPv6 advocates are frustrated that we're not neglecting IPv4. But V6 was finished up technically in 1998, and then it saw remarkably slow adoption compared to what people had anticipated. There was a lot of inertia. There was a lot of lack of awareness. There was a lot of lack of interest. So IPv6 adoption is pretty strong in Northern Europe. It's pretty strong on mobile data, on cellular networks. It's pretty strong in some developing countries that are very large, and it's pretty strong for some major internet brands. But remarkably, most of the traffic on the internet, almost 25 years later, is still IPv4. And there are many reasons for that, and there's lots of discussion about who is to blame, how much of a problem this is. I'm going to be talking about that later this week when I introduce a proposal at IETF, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. But the really concrete impact that we saw, kind of as predicted, as anticipated, is that early in the 2010s, the pool of available IPv4 addresses that had never been allocated ran out. And so a market emerged to resell previously allocated addresses. This was especially beneficial to hosting companies as buyers and organizations that got on the internet early on because they often were given extremely large number of addresses. So for example, people who have some affiliation with MIT may recall having had IP addresses beginning with 18. And actually MIT itself, just the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, had every IP address beginning with 18, so-called /8 allocation, which is enormous and was much larger than the Institute needed or could use. And it was able to actually resell some of those addresses as a scarce resource and make money from them. And on the demand side, running out of addresses is especially difficult for hosting companies because the customers of hosting companies, even if they really like IPv6 and even if they fully support it, typically, they still need IPv4 addresses in order to be reachable by the fairly substantial, fairly significant, fairly large IPv4-only client base, user base. And it's been said that this is now a measurable and observable and increasing part of the cost if you want to host public internet services. So if you want to get a hosting provider and host some kind of website, host some kind of IRC service, host some kind of video conferencing service, any kind of public service that you might want to host, you're going to have a payment directly or indirectly built in to your bill for IPv4 addresses. And that's going to grow and has been growing as a share of the cost of hosting internet services. And so our project, the IPv4 Unicast Extensions Project, has identified a lot of addresses that were given special meanings back in the 1980s. We're proposing to change internet standards to unreserve these addresses and to ask implementations, software implementations, to treat these addresses as ordinary internet addresses, which are, as a retronym, called Unicast, by contrast with other things that were subsequently invented. So these addresses were reserved for various historical reasons, and they're not really serving a purpose. We're not really getting a benefit from the ways that these addresses were reserved and given special meanings. And unreserving them, turning them into normal IPv4 addresses, would free up a very significant amount of IPv4 space, for which there is an enormous demand, which continues. We would also then like to work with the internet measurement community to test how well these addresses can actually be used on the internet, because there are many reasons to expect, since current standards say that these addresses are not valid, that they would not immediately be usable everywhere. And so we'd like to actually engage in practical testing to see how useful they can be made. And if it turns out that they can be made useful over the next few years, they could be allocated for use to identify, for example, public internet services. So as I mentioned, when it was less clear where the internet was going and how popular it would be, there were various decisions that were made that treated lots of addresses specially, and I'm going to talk about which kinds of addresses. And it turns out, in hindsight, that a lot of those decisions were not helpful, and the purposes for which they reserve those addresses are not beneficial. Right. Okay, I think I already talked about this, that we basically ran out of addresses. IPv6 attempts to address this with a much larger address space and is very useful and is in active use, but people still want to interoperate with the IPv4 network. About 7% of all of IPv4 was reserved or given special meanings in that early phase, and I'm not counting there cases like U.S. military organizations were given a very significant amount of space, and a few universities were given a significant amount of space, and a few companies that were on the internet early were given a very significant amount of space. But I'm just talking about space that effectively can't be used at all, rather than space that may be underutilized based on these early decisions. So we have four drafts over at the Internet Engineering Task Force. We presented the first two of them last year at the IETF 112 meeting. And the other two officially are up this coming Tuesday, 2 days from now, over at IETF 113 in Vienna, which I'll be joining online. But the main event this week for us is going to be another draft on the broader question about the IETF's role in maintaining IPv4, which some people have questioned and have questioned often in regard to our other proposals, where a lot of people have said, this protocol is obsolete, we should not be working on it anymore, we should not be trying to make it better, we should just be trying to push people onto IPv6. And for various reasons, which I'll discuss on Tuesday, and which we've discussed in our draft, we think it's still constructive activity to continue to maintain IPv4 alongside IPv6. And so we're proposing this as a matter of IETF policy. Okay, so here's a chart of some of the address space that we're talking about. And I'm going to go through each of these individually, but there's the lowest address. There's 240/4, there's 0/8, there's 127/8. And in each of these cases, the blue is showing an example of what value would be in a particular part of the number that would give it a special meaning that we're proposing to undo. And so each of these proposals is a kind of address space, and each of them frees up some number of addresses, which is in each case in the millions, or tens or hundreds of millions. So one example is the lowest address on each network. So suppose we have this network like 42.43.44.0/24. Now, in the 1980s, the developers at UC Berkeley chose the lowest address, which would be the .0 in this case, as a broadcast address. Developers elsewhere chose the highest address, which would be the .255 for the broadcast address. And this is an address that refers to all of the machines that are connected to that network. So ultimately, the highest address won out when this became standardized later on, but the lowest address continued to be reserved for backwards compatibility with 4.2 BSD from the early 1980s, which, to our knowledge, is not online anywhere in the world at all. And this is continuing to waste one address on every subnet across the entire internet. A cool thing about this, which I won't go into in at great length, is that actually, according to existing standards, you could just fix this on your own network, and people outside of your network would be able to talk to a machine that you might put up at the lowest address. And they don't have to change anything. They just have to follow the existing standards. So this is something that people could fix unilaterally on their own networks and get one bonus address on their networks, unlike our other proposals, which do require more internet-wide coordination. Okay, so the biggest block of addresses that we're talking about is the so-called experimental range, which is reserved for future use, and that's every address from 240 on up. And the purpose of reserving these was to future-proof the internet protocol in case a new kind of addressing came out. So there were lots of reasons, there were lots of research, reasons to think that a new kind of addressing might come out, but it turned out that it didn't, and so these addresses have still not been used for anything. And it's very unlikely that a new kind of IPv4 addressing mode or method will be invented now, especially considering the enthusiasm that we've seen for people not doing anything at all with IPv4. But this is a lot of addresses. This is hundreds of millions of addresses that have just been reserved for future use and still remain reserved for future use. Now, also at the very bottom of the IPv4 address space, all of the addresses beginning with a zero are reserved. Again, due to a decision in 1981, this was meant to be used for auto-configuration. So when you connect a device to the internet, it needs to get a configuration somehow to learn what its own address should be. Now, you may know that what we usually use for that now is called DHCP. There were earlier methods, and there was a proposed method that I believe was never even implemented and that was officially deprecated in 1989. But all of the addresses beginning with zero were reserved evidently for the use of that auto-configuration method that was never used and is never used. And those addresses remain reserved today. Probably the most controversial of our proposals, and one that got a lot of attention and raised a lot of controversy, is about the loopback addresses. So these are all of the addresses beginning with 127. And these are addresses that are given a special meaning. And the special meaning is this computer. So a way for a computer to talk to itself using the internet protocol. Now, IP version 6 just has one address for this purpose, but IP version 4 has 2 to the 24th different addresses. And that's a lot, considering that arguably we might be able to get by with 1 instead of 2 to the 24th. But there was a decision that all of these would be reserved, that all of these would be given a special loopback meaning. It's not very common for any but the very lowest ones to be used at all. There is apparently a VPN product in Japan that uses them, and I have so far not been able to identify any other software that actually uses the remaining addresses in 127. Yeah, so we don't really know how to measure exactly how many addresses we would reclaim with the lowest address proposal, because we don't know how many subnets there are. People who connect networks to the internet can choose how big their subnets are and how many subnets they have. They can break up their block into smaller blocks, and each time they subdivide that way, they waste one address with the lowest address duplicate broadcast. So however many of those subnets there are, we would reclaim one address for each of them. For the 240 block, we would reclaim about 268 million. And for the 0 and 127 blocks, we would reclaim about 16 million. And so all in all, we would reclaim hundreds of millions, about 7% of the address space. Okay, so I want to talk about software, and this is going to get into a tree software connection. So a very surprising thing, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a few moments, is that for the 240 range, most Unix-based operating systems actually already support this. And they already support it because a proposal much like our proposal was made back in 2008. And a lot of operating system developers thought that was a cool idea and just went ahead and made the change, even though that proposal actually was never adopted as a consensus of the IETF. For the lowest address, we and our colleagues got patches merged in the Linux kernel and in FreeBSD. So those systems in their most recent versions support using the lowest address to number a computer instead of using it as a broadcast address. And the 0/8, our project got a patch in the Linux kernel. And for 127, the most controversial one, I'm not aware of any systems that support this. We've written patches, but we have not proposed those patches to be merged in the default behavior of operating systems. So interesting things about this effort include that they mostly involve removing special cases from implementations of the Internet Protocol, and then testing interoperability to make sure that everything works. Generally, when we've made these changes or other people have made these changes, no one has noticed them. They haven't really impacted anything, which we think of as a very good sign, in the sense that if anyone were concerned that something is going to break or something is going to be harmed, there's really no indication of that. Most people are just unaware that their systems are willing to interoperate with addresses that, according to current internet standards, are not valid. And we're continuing to work on and propose software patches for various systems. One thing that I find very funny about this is that it's an opportunity for me or for other people to contribute a negative amount of code to various free software projects. So I have some recollection many years ago of having proposed a patch that changed a reference to bin from user bin. And if I'm right in my recollection about that, it means that I got -4 bytes of code of my own in the operating system in question. And so this project also is an opportunity to get negative lines of code contributions, because we go into kernel code and we find that there's a special case where it says essentially, and I have some pseudocode, but essentially if the address is larger than this, reject it. And our contribution, among other things, and there's certainly testing and there's certainly documentation and there are other things, but our contribution to the kernel code is typically removing those lines. Right. So it looks something like this, and this is sort of C-like pseudocode. We're saying, like, if the packet destination address is larger than 240, reject the packet. If the packet destination address is smaller than 1, meaning beginning with 0, then reject the packet. This is not valid C code because you don't actually write IP addresses in this format in C. And so you might imagine it as this kind of Goldilocks and the Three Bears phenomenon, that the operating system is saying, this address is too big. And then it's saying, in this case, this address is too small. But if those cases don't apply, it's saying, this address is just right. And then it goes ahead and processes it and treats the packet as valid and goes ahead with sending or receiving it. And so our kernel changes, roughly speaking, are just like removing this part and removing this part so that these addresses will be considered acceptable and will be considered valid. Now, again, there are other things that have to be done, but in the Linux kernel, even before our project existed, another developer proposed that 240/4 should no longer be treated specially. The developers were fine with that. That was, again, in response to a different proposal at IETF. In 2019, my colleague Dave Tat got his patch in to fix up some aspects of unreserving 0/8 in Linux kernel. And my patch landed last year to unreserve the lowest address in each subnet. And this was actually a really nice thing in terms of the free software development experience, in the sense that it was very evident what the process was to propose these changes, and it was very evident who was responsible, and very evident how to go about making the change, proposing the change, testing the change, and advocating for it. And the developers were very open to the idea that this was just a good idea, and to listening to various people's arguments for these things. Now, Mike Carrolls wrote a patch based on our patch for FreeBSD. And I think that's especially cool, because the whole reason that the lowest address has been treated specially is because of compatibility with the historic BSD systems. And so the very newest FreeBSD behavior is no longer to treat that specially. And I'm working on 240/4 fixes in FreeBSD and OpenBSD. We don't know for sure whether the developers of these systems will agree to make that behavior a default, but it's great that it's straightforward to find the places in the kernel where code needs to be removed, where code needs to be changed. Now, there is a bit of a contrast with proprietary systems. Since this is an internet standards effort, we definitely are trying to get our proposals to be adopted by all systems across the whole internet, whether they're free or proprietary, so that they can all interoperate with each other. And certainly the free software systems have been much easier, partly in terms of being able to approach them, because most free software is developed in a moderately to extremely public way, where it's fairly clear how someone with an idea can come in and propose that idea to the project. And we don't really have an equivalent for proprietary systems. Now, Darwin is somewhere in between, because Apple has a free kernel for a proprietary operating system. And I have actually made patches to implement our changes on Darwin, but I can't test them, and I'm not exactly sure where to propose them. I've been trying to find developers at Apple whom I might approach, but they're not exactly out there on a public mailing list talking about their network implementation and talking about who's responsible. And Microsoft really has shown no interest in any of these proposals, and users don't really have a way that's a straightforward way that they could make these kinds of changes without help from Microsoft. And so there is this real contrast in the free and proprietary systems in terms of approachability, in terms of self-help, in terms of users saying, I agree with this change, so I want to make it on my own system, in terms of knowing where to go to ask the operating system to do something differently. Obviously, to say nothing of being able to find the spot in the code that we have to change. Right. So a fun thing is that you may actually be watching this presentation on a device right now that's capable of interoperating with the 240/4 reserved addresses, because this change was made in many systems around 2008 to 2009. And so it's quite plausible that you're watching this on a device right now that can deal with that, that's fine with it. One thing that we've tried to do to illustrate this to people is set up Wi-Fi networks with 240/4 internal addresses and with NAT. And the really cool thing with this is that typically clients other than Windows worked fine out of the box on such a network. So usually we would use a customized OpenWRT for the Wi-Fi router, and we're going to propose some changes in OpenWRT to ask them to have better support for previously reserved addresses. But you can try this yourself. You can just, instead of using officially private address space, you can use addresses beginning with 240 and just see if they work and see which devices are willing to accept them. And as I mentioned, Microsoft is really an outlier in continuing to actively forbid interoperability with these addresses across its line of proprietary operating systems, although that behavior definitely does follow the existing published internet standards. So they're not doing something non-standard. They're just not making a change that has found a lot of popularity and a lot of support among other operating system implementations. So there is this difficulty there that when we make changes that are not inherently backwards compatible, that you could have two machines that disagree about the validity of an address. So one of them might say, according to internet standards and according to my operating system code, addresses in that range are not allowed to be used at all. And the other one might say, well, according to my code, it's allowed to be used, and that's my address. And those two machines then may not be able to communicate with each other. And of course, it takes time to update software and to get changes rolled out. Even in the systems that we've succeeded in patching, they're not necessarily patches that have been rolled out to everything running those operating systems. There's a certain delay in the development process. Not all of the systems based on the Linux kernel, for example, are running anywhere near the most recent kernel version. Many of them are running somewhat patched versions of kernels that were released years ago. And so it will take some time to get widespread support in devices, even assuming that people, operating system developers, device vendors are willing to make these changes. So to me, that's a clear indication that we would be much better off if we had all started officially and consistently across the board in 2008 with the earlier proposal that I mentioned. Having not necessarily done that, it seems straightforward to me to say we should do it now. We should start now planting the tree, so to speak, so that the tree will actually have been planted another decade or two decades from now, so that we'll actually have a wider panoply, a wider range of operating systems and code deployed to devices in the world that's willing to accept previously reserved addresses for numbering. And as I mentioned, we'd like to work with the measurement community because clearly systems have been encouraged by various documentation and standards to prevent the use of these. And ISPs, for example, may well be following advice that encourages them to prevent the use of reserved addresses. And there have been good reasons for doing so. And so if we're changing that, we're going to have to get changes in behavior, not just of end user devices, but also, for example, of internet routers and also of practices of internet service providers that make up the internet. So we'd like to work with the community to get some metrics about how well these do or don't work. We'd like to do that now, and also assuming that we can get a consensus that these changes should be made, following that consensus over time to see how usable are these addresses, how widely blocked are they. So an analogy that I like, that not everyone finds perfectly analogous, but Cloudflare, the CDN company, got permission to use the rather memorable address 1.1.1.1 for a public DNS service, which they started back in 2018. Now, that address range was actually not used on the internet before that, and so quite a lot of networks had hard-coded blocking it. So Cloudflare actively went around and said, if you have trouble reaching our 1.1.1.1 service, please join us on this forum and talk about it. Tell us who your ISP is, gather some data, tell us how to contact the ISP. And they worked with the ISPs to remove these blocks, and they worked with the user community to remove these blocks. And they got extremely high reachability over time for the new 1.1.1.1 service. So this is not exactly analogous in the sense that those ISPs that had blocked 1.1.1.1 were not actually following official internet standards in doing so. They were just observing that that address was often used as a test range or something, and that there was no existing real service there, and so they had commonly blocked it on their own initiative. And by contrast with the addresses that we're talking about, certainly ISPs that are blocking them based on official standards that say that they should block them and that those addresses are not valid. But the amount of progress and the rapidity of the progress that Cloudflare made working with its user community, I find very encouraging. And it seems to me that we could follow a similar process with formerly reserved addresses some years from now, assuming that software support for them becomes widespread by default and there's a common understanding that it is acceptable to use these addresses on the internet for some purposes. There are a lot of concerns that have come up, both at the IETF, at the standards organization, And on email discussion lists for network operators, those include both technical concerns in terms of how well it will work, how well can we update devices, how feasible is it to make a non-backwards compatible change on the internet, and then policy concerns like, should we do this? And we've tried to respond to all of those concerns, and it really seems like the question of the legitimacy, the appropriateness of continuing to maintain IPv4 is the deepest, most fundamental source of disagreement here. Because in many cases, people have said, oh, that wouldn't work well right away. Oh, that wouldn't work well quickly or something. And we've said, well, that's okay. We want to plant the tree now. Then maybe in 10 years, in 15 years, we would have this supply of addresses available that would be pretty interoperable and pretty usable, because a lot of operating systems would have been updated in that time. But a lot of people have said, well, really the solution is to switch to IPv6. And really the solution is not to continue to try to find IPv4 address spaces to meet this demand, but to try to eliminate the demand or obviate the demand by switching to V6. And I have a lot of sympathy with that point of view, in the sense that I really appreciate the work that has been done on V6. And I think that supporting and adopting IPv6 is a good thing to do and an appropriate thing to do. One difficulty, of course, is that this demand doesn't necessarily come from people who are opposed to IPv6. It doesn't necessarily come from people who don't want to use IPv6. In our impression, the largest portion of the demand for IPv4 address space actually comes from hosting companies that support IPv6, but their customers also want V4, because their customers are going to have users of their public services who don't have V6. And there's no way that the hosting customers can unilaterally change that and make that not so, right? If you want to put up an IRC network, if you want to put up a website and you want people to be able to visit it from all around the world, you're almost certainly going to need an IPv4 address for that. And that's true even if you're very, very enthusiastic about IPv6 and you fully support IPv6 and you encourage people to use it, you're still going to have users who are on V4. So we've had this disagreement saying, well, there's still this demand and there's still going to be this demand for some time. And it would be great if this demand decreased because of increased adoption of IPv6. But we don't think that that can be done by fiat. We don't think that that can be done by telling people, you shouldn't want IPv4 addresses. And so we have proposed this document, which I'm going to be presenting again virtually in Vienna on Tuesday, asserting that it's legitimate and appropriate to continue to maintain IPv4, that we should still be officially allowed to work on it. Some other interesting questions that have come up in the context of doing this project include the questions about upgrading the internet in general, upgrading the systems on the internet. If there are reasons to change the internet in ways that are not fully backwards compatible, how feasible is that? How resistant are people to that? How many systems are there that are running operating systems that were released many years ago that are not getting any updates at all? What's the relationship between specifications and practice? The internet standardization process has famously been defined as running on rough consensus and running code. And so one interesting question is how those two relate to each other. And then whose responsibility is all of these things anyway? And I think a lot of these questions are kind of fascinating. You know, I also have done some work in my previous job at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I worked on creating the Let's Encrypt Certificate Authority, which is, I talked about at Libre Planet a couple of years ago. And that certificate authority had a certificate that it relied on expire last year, which resulted in a transition to a new root certificate authority, which was a non-backwards compatible change. And it was unfortunately, interestingly painful for a lot of people. to see that change. So there are a lot of interesting questions, not just about this proposal, but in general. If something non-fully backwards compatible needs to happen on the internet for some reason, how well can that happen? So again, we're doing some of our own testing.
Time, so you may want to think about moving into a Q&A part.
Yeah, I'm just getting the note that
very good.
We'll be doing Q&A in a moment. And I have just two more slides, so it's pretty decent timing. So we've been doing our own testing. As I said, we'd like to do some wider scale testing, and we do think it will be years before these things will come into practice. So I want to mention ways that you can help if you're interested in this. One, of course, is to try using reserved addresses on your own networks. For example, you can try it on your own Wi-Fi network. Let us know if this does or doesn't work, or if you know of other things that would conflict with this. Support our proposals over at IETF. Encourage vendors to support previously reserved address ranges. If you have a well-connected network somewhere or an always-on network somewhere, there are various internet measurement projects. That would actually be an interesting topic for someone to talk about at Libre Planet, if that hasn't been presented. These are projects that let you run a client that then let researchers run experiments that are internet-wide experiments about how well does the internet work? How reachable are things? What routes do packets take? Right. So there are various kinds of measurement nodes that you can run on host on your network that then allow researchers of various kinds to choose to run experiments that make use of your connection. And we don't have any commitments from these projects, but we are very interested in discussing with them the prospect of doing experiments with reserved address spaces. And I guess a real general big picture conclusion is please make sure that systems you work on can be upgraded in case changes are needed. And that's not in any way specific to these proposals, but includes the root certificate authority issue, includes security fixes, includes any number of changes that may become necessary. So please try to ensure that whatever systems you work on and develop can be upgraded, because there's a high likelihood that some kind of changes will be useful or important at some point in the future. So thanks very much, and I'm happy to take questions quickly. I know we just have a few minutes. And these are my email address and John Gilmore's email address if you'd like to get in touch with us about this project. And again, thanks for tuning in, and we can do a couple of questions quickly.
Very good. Excellent talk there. Yes, first question is from Corwin. Do you have any pet theories as to why the adoption of IPv6 has been so slow?
Yeah, I mean, so to be clear, I feel really sad about the slowness of the adoption of V6. I did give talks in the 90s encouraging it and so on. I think one thing is that some people have said it didn't have unique value propositions or selling propositions, to use some business jargon. You didn't really get anything observable or measurable from adopting it, except for a good feeling that you were helping the internet as a whole. And the good feeling that you're helping the internet as a whole is a good thing, and definitely something that's motivated a lot of people. But it might have been helpful if there were other more concrete incentives. It's an interesting question. It's a long topic. I think also the extremely decentralized nature of the internet has made this kind of challenging, because there are still networks that are run by people who have not really heard about this, or who are not really that well connected to other communities that could help them or that could motivate them with it, or that are using software or hardware that maybe doesn't support it that well, or they don't know how. And so that decentralization has meant, gosh, we need to get all of these people all around the world who may be fairly happy with their IPv4 internet experience to do this thing where they won't immediately see a concrete benefit to themselves. And that's tricky.
That really merges into the next question from Noisy Toot. So wouldn't implementing this IPv6 be, or what wouldn't be implementing the fix-up of IPv4 be just as hard as implementing IPv6?
Yeah, so a lot of people have raised that kind of concern. And the main thing that I've said is that my talks back in 1999, for example, were talking about how the Linux kernel had already gotten a working IPv6 implementation in 1999. And so a really substantial amount of software actually has very good IPv6 support, including operating systems in many cases that are a decade or more in age. And so it doesn't seem to me from the software implementation point of view that there's that much remaining to be done for v6. Now, for the deployment on networks, that's another matter. To some extent, for the deployment on public services, that's another matter. But for software support is generally there. And so I've said, if you can identify a particular device or particular system that is lacking IPv6 support, then I definitely think that adding v6 support for that should be a very high priority and is a very valuable thing to do. It just seems for a lot of the systems that we're looking at, v6 actually already works on those systems. You just may not necessarily be able to get it from your ISP. That's certainly my situation at home. I'm using 3 software phones and laptops and everything that would be perfectly happy to do v6, but my residential ISP doesn't offer it. And so I think basically, v6 would be a great thing to do, but in the implementer side, surprisingly, has often already been done.
I'm exactly in that same mode of my ISP doesn't offer IPv6 here as well. There was another question about NAT related to IPv6, and I'm not familiar with this part at all, but the question was about NAT being used in some IPv6 to IPv4 gateways, and if you had any information about those special cases.
Yeah, so one thing you can do if you're a residential ISP, if you don't have enough V4 addresses, is that you can give people private or so-called carrier-grade NAT addresses in V4 on your network, and then you can forward that to V6 on the public side. And so that is a way that some residential ISPs have been able to make do with fewer or no additional IPv4 addresses. And that is a mechanism that's worked okay in various ways for residential ISPs. It does make it a lot harder for people to host things at home, which is another big picture long-term discussion about all of the different obstacles to hosting things at home, to hosting public internet services at home. But for residential ISPs that are not especially committed to facilitating hosting at home, they do have that kind of option. By contrast, if you want to host something publicly for the whole world, again, you're probably going to need V4 addresses to some extent, because there are probably going to be visitors coming to your sites, coming to your services who have...
Very good. And unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time, so I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. That was an excellent talk, and it definitely generated a lot of discussion in the channel. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy the rest of LibrePlanet, everybody. Take care.